final topic of our agenda, which is at least topic of discussion, is the business combinations under common control, and I give the floor to Anna Maria.
Good morning, everyone. So, as you probably are aware of, the board has restarted the deliberation on the project in October, and this was after the project was confirmed on the research agenda. Now, the objective of today's session is really to discuss with you, on one side, the scope of the project, both what the board has decided so far and what we are going to recommend to the board in December, so next week. And this is covered by slide X1, which is agenda paper 8A. And on the other side, we'd like to discuss with you some initial consideration regarding the methods of accounting for transaction in the scope of the project. And this is covered by slide X2, agenda paper 8B. So let's start with agenda paper 8A, so scope of the project. I will provide you like some background information on the first decision on scope the board made in 2014, and we will then move to the clarification the board discussed in October and will discuss in December. And I'll probably pause between the two to ask you some questions and give you the opportunity to provide them. So in June 2014, the board decided that the project should consider business combination under common control, excluded from the scope of IFRS 3, group restructuring, and also whether there is a need to clarify the description of business combination under common control. And the main drivers of that decision were, well, your feedback, so the feedback of, from ASAS member, some concern raised by security regulator, but more importantly, the fact that IFRS standard generally do not include scope exclusion for transaction under common control, apart from the scope exclusion in IFRS 3 for business combination. So, and a summary of this consideration is illustrated in slide 8. So, the quadrant the board should really focus on this project is the great quadrant on the bottom. So, transaction under common control that involve the transfer of a business. And of course, the board recognized that there might be some interaction with similar transactions, and similar transaction because are all under common control, or similar transaction because all involve the transfer of a business. And these interactions will be considered by the staff as the project progresses, but all these transactions are not, strictly speaking, in the scope of this, the project. Now, if we move to slide 11, so starting from the decision the board made in 2014, so what the staff noted is that one of the elements of that decision, which is group restructuring, is not a defined term and might be interpreted differently by different parties. And a second element of the board decision, which is business combination under common control, is described in IFRS 3, but there are some application questions on that description. So the board addressed the first concern in October and is going to address the second concern in December. So let's focus on the October decision. So what we did in October is we since group restructuring is not a defined term and there is some confusion around what is group restructuring, we stepped back and we, in order to identify and describe the population of transactions that should be included in the scope of the project, we consider transfer of businesses under common, between entity under common control. And we noted that any such transfer will involve a controlling party, a transferring party, a transfer party, and a receiving party. And we analyze the transfer of a business from the perspective of these different parties. And if we look at slide 16, where a very simple transaction is illustrated, so in that case, entity A acquire entity B, the accounting of such transaction at the parent level, so P, at the transferring party level, so B, and the transfer for the transfer business, C, is already covered by IFRS standard. The only level, the only perspective which is not covered by IFRS standard and need to be addressed by this project is really the perspective of the receiving entity. And this is true regardless of whether an acquirer can be identified in that transaction. So regardless of whether the transaction satisfied the description of business combination on the common control. So the board decided to clarify that the project will address the accounting for transaction under common control in which the reporting entity obtained control over one or more businesses, but regardless of whether IFRS 3 would identify the reporting entity as the acquirer if IFRS 3 were applied to the transaction. And this means that in the project, in the scope of the project, there are transactions that satisfy that description, the description of business combination under common control, and other transactions, such as the transaction which is illustrated in slide 18, which, by the way, was a scenario submitted to the Interpretation Committee in 2011. Now, before pausing, I'd also like to clarify that the board decided to focus on transaction in the scope of the project. So the board did not specify to which financial statements, separate, consolidated, or individual, any requirements in this project, developed by this project, will apply. And this is because the financial statements affected by the accounting requirements developed by this project will depend on the specific transaction, as illustrated in slide 22. And this is also consistent with how the scope is defined in IFRS 3. So focus on the transaction, not on the financial statements. I will now pose and ask you whether you agree with the scope of the project as clarified in October by the board. And in particular, I would like to ask you whether, in your view, we are covering the right set of transactions. And of course, if not, why?
Cédric.
Hans, we are quite supportive of the change in scope. I think it will extend the current scope and will cover what is expected. There are some situations where we have pooling of interest before an IPO, so the question of not having an acquirer is maybe an important one. Just one question: do you also contemplate to enlarge the scope to IS 28 and have the equity method associates or joint venture within the scope?
So you are referring to the acquisition of an associate from an entity under common control. As I said before, this is like a transaction which interact with the transaction that are in the scope of the project, and of course the staff will consider this interaction as the project progresses. But these transactions, strictly speaking, are not in the scope of the project. So the scope of the project is really when a reporting entity obtained control over one or more businesses.
Tommaso?
Thank you. We are very supportive, not quite, of the project. Yeah.
What did we do wrong?
I remember that the first paper I prepared when I joined in 2008, the OIC was about presenting a project at the at AFRAG. It was at that time the PAE. It was Steve, chairman of AFRAG on Business Commission and Common Control. So we are certainly very, very supportive of this project, and we are happy. Also with the scope, we think that the scope is very well identified. I have one comment and one question. The comment is, I understand that the implication for several financial statements are out of the scope when the transaction the business commission common control is recognized in a separate financial statement with an acquisition of an investment in subsidiary. So when the, you know, the outcome is a recognition of an investment in subsidiary. However, I think this item should be even considered during the project, because I wouldn't really like to see a transaction in a consolidated financial statement is treated like, you know, a distribution or contribution towards owners, and in this, at the same time, such a transaction is not recognized as such in the separate financial statement. So this could be further considered. And I have one question on slide 9, where you are referring to the point about the analogy that the question that was raised to the IFRS-IC. I understand that the tentative decision is not has not been finalized. My question is whether we should not expect will be finalized or because of this project, or you have still planned to rediscuss within the board before the completion of this project?
Well, regarding the agenda decision, not finalized agenda decision, I probably hand over to Sue.
I think that the plan is that we're going to try and get further down the track with the work on BCUCC and then make a decision on what the appropriate next steps might be for the Interpretations Committee. So we're sort of waiting and watching.
And as I said before, I mean, this is one of the interaction we will consider in our mm-hmm. project. So the acquisition of an associate from an entity under common control is not within our scope, but we will consider.
Christina?
Thank you. So AOSSG generally supports the proposal to consider all types of structures or transactions. If for whatever reason you're unable to analyse all of the transactions, there's a call for the ISB to maybe focus on the types of issues that have been raised to IFRIC. There initially was some confusion on whether separate financial statements is out of this project. But I think you've clarified that the focus is on the reporting entity. So the group would like to say, well, whatever it is, don't ignore, you know, how it would be accounted for in separate financial statements.
Yeah. And well, regarding separate financial statements, it's really the illustration in slide 23 is really informative. I mean, the financial statement that will be impacted will be affected by the requirements in this developed by this project. It really depends on the specific of the transaction, because if A in that case acquired B and B is a separate entity that continue as a separate legal entity with its legal shell, of course the financial statement affected will be the consolidated mm-hmm. financial statement, because in the separate financial statement this is an acquisition of investment and there is IAS 27. Whereas if B is not a separate legal entity mm-hmm. Or not continue as a separate legal entity, of course, all the financial statement that is reporting as PPA will be affected by it.
Thank you, Hans. We agree not to limit the scope of the project to transactions that meet the definition of BCUCC. However, before discussing the accounting treatment, we think it's important to clarify who the reporting entity is, whether the reporting entity is preparing consolidated financial statement or a separate financial statement, and who the users are. Furthermore, we think the rationale for the accounting for BCUCC should be consistent with the accounting for divestitures, and it's desirable to discuss the two at the same time.
Andrew?
Thank you, guys. Well, I appreciate the project becoming active once again. It's been like a sort of semi-active volcano that every now and again rumbles into life and a bit of lava spits out and it goes quiet for a few years. So hopefully it can have a good run through.
It only produces steam, doesn't
it? Indeed. That said, we're very supportive, like other speakers, of what they're trying to achieve with the scope and including certain new co-transactions, for example, pre-IPO new co-transactions. Yeah, in due course, we get into the detail. I think it is going to be challenging to sort of get the words exactly right to include what you want to include and exclude what you want to exclude. And you could change one or two of these examples very slightly. So put an asset into NewCo, and we today would say that's actually basically a reverse asset acquisition, therefore in substance a purchase of an asset. I don't think you want to include those, but finding the right words to sort of include what you want to include is going to be tricky, but obviously we'll be happy to help with that process at the appropriate time.
Yeah, we are aware of the challenge.
Yeah, good luck.
Thanks, Hans. Yeah, also very supportive of the proposed scope and also the focus on the reporting entity, so it's not necessarily only consolidated financial statements. So, yeah.
Okay.
Thanks. So, overall, we agree with the scope of the project, in particular on your slide 8. I think that's a very nice depiction of how you're going to actually have to work your way through this project. Because as you move through this, because there's so many, there's such a range of transactions that potentially you're going to have to deal with, having the discipline to say, okay, this is where I think it fits in, and then testing it, and double-checking that what you think is dealt with in other standards is actually dealt with in other standards, and also probably having to think your way through while you're working the impact on the consolidated entity versus the separate statements. We think that's a very systematic approach, and we think that if you can continue to do that all the way through the project with us helping you with different fact patterns, it makes a lot of sense.
Chris?
So similar comments to everyone else. We're very supportive of having the scope cover things which don't necessarily have a business combination acquirer, but do involve the transfer of a business. I'd also just, while we're on page 8, my comment would be I'm not so sure that when you're not transferring a business, you're just transferring individual assets under common control, that those things are actually covered by current standards. But certainly I would not want you to be expanding the scope of the BCUCC project to look at that issue at this particular point in time. Mm-hmm. But given that this is a public document, I think you just need to be a bit careful to say it's not really covered, because I do know that if you transfer assets at nominal value, there's not necessarily agreement on how that should work, whether it's at book value or fair value.
As opposed to it being specifically scoped out, you're just saying it might not be clear what it is required.
What the actual accounting is, yeah.
Which is a slightly different point.
Okay, we can move to what's coming in December now. So as I said before, one of the elements of the initial board decision regarding scope is business combination under common control. And business combination under common control are described in IFRS 3 as a business combination in which all the combining entity or businesses are ultimately controlled by the same party or parties both before and after business combination, and the control is not transitory. So the key component of this description are that the transaction needs to be a business combination, but that's defined in IFRS 3. All the combining entity are controlled by the same party or parties. But again, IFRS 3 includes some application guidance on this regard. And finally, that control, that common control, needs to be not transitory. But IFRS 3 does not elaborate further on that concept. And in fact, the Interpretation Committee has received some submission related to the meaning of transitory control, and also some summation related to situation where a business combination is conditional to the success of an IPO. Probably it might be worth a quickly look at this submission before moving to our recommendations. So in slide 26, the Interpretation Committee was asked to consider a group restructuring involving the formation of a new entity to facilitate the sale of a part of a group. And if we look at the initial situation, it's a very simple structure. So A and B are two entities, two businesses controlled by the same party. And this party forms a new co to facilitate the sale of the group and transfer to that new co A and B, and then new co goes public. So some party, some stakeholder argue that the control of the NewCo is transitory. Therefore, this is not a business combination under common control, but it is a normal business combination, and IFRS 3 must be applied to that transaction. And the interpretation committee at that time decided to do not ask that issue on its agenda and refer to our project. A second submission, a second set of submissions related to the conditional IPO scenario, and in that case, the transaction is pretty much the same as the one I've just described. So there is like this NewCo created by the parents that acquire A and B. But in that case, the acquisition of A and B by NewCo is effective only on condition of the occurrence of the IPO, of the success of the IPO. And in this scenario, some party argue that the condition is really relevant to the analysis. Therefore, the IPO takes place before the acquisition. And if we take this view, P does not control entity, the NewCo and A and B at the time of the acquisition. Therefore, this is not a business combination under common control. And once again, IFRS 3 must be applied to that transaction. But other argue that the condition is not so relevant and the IPO does not take place before the acquisition. Therefore, entity P actually control NewCo and A and B at the time of the acquisition. However, there are different views as to whether this control, so entity P control, is transitory or not. If it is transitory, well, this is not a business combination, and once again, IFRS 3 must be applied. If it is not transitory, then this is a business combination under common control, and the scope exclusion in IFRS 3 applied. And once again, the interpretation committee decided to do not add this topic on its agenda and refer to our project. Now, in all these circumstances, answering the specific application question received by the committee will draw the line between business combination and business combination under common control. However, what we noted is that as the project progresses, this distinction might not remain relevant, and especially if the board decided that some or all business combination must be accounted for under the acquisition method set out in IFRS 3. So the important distinction in that case will become the distinction between transactions that are accounted for applying the acquisition method and transactions that are accounted for applying another method. And this is illustrated in slide 30. So what we are recommending to the board is really, instead of focusing on the distinction between business combination and business combination under common control, the board should focus on filling the gap in the accounting requirement for business combination. And on that basis, we recommend that the scope of the project also includes transaction where application question exists as to whether the control is or is not transitory, or transactions that are conditional to a future sale, such as in an IPO. And in other words, what we are suggesting is, instead of answering this specific application question now, we suggest the board to focus on the core, the fundamental question all these stakeholders are asking, which is, how do I account for that transaction? So I'll now pose and ask you whether you agree with staff recommendation, and of course, if not, why. And I will also add that our intention is, during the December board meeting, to provide the board with an oral update on the feedback we received from you today.
Tommaso.
Yeah, I agree, Anna. This is exactly the point. I think that the project should identify and specify how this transaction, which a NewCo is constituted just for a future IPO, should be accounted, even if it's a business combination, a business combination of proper control. And the example in slide, the case in slide 28-29 is an example that explains how this exception can create problems, because you can structure easily a transaction to, you know, list a NewCo and to avoid any negative effect of being considered this transaction a business combination under common control. So this should be taken into consideration in the development of the project. I agree. The problem is how do I account for the transfer of a business towards a new co before listing. I don't know, for example, if in the US you have like a push down accounting in these circumstances, that would be also.
Yeah, so I'm actually not sure.
You would, to be honest, you would not have push down accounting. You're saying upon IPO? You wouldn't have pushed out accounting in that situation.
Thank you.
Christina?
Yeah, we also support not drawing a distinction between, not focusing your effort in looking at the differences. Speaking from experience in Hong Kong, we fell into that trap and we just couldn't get out of it. And then we realized that actually the root cause of this issue is we don't really know what is transitory control. So I think that's something that we probably need to think about, what we mean by something, whether you have control that's transitory.
No further comments, Chris?
So again, just supportive, we do think that that's the right scoping to be looking at transfers of a business, as I said, without necessarily looking at whether or not you've got an acquirer under the definitions in 3.
Okay.
So we can move to the second slide deck now. So agenda paper A to B. And this session is really all about accounting methods that could be applied to transaction in the scope of the project. And these are all preliminary consideration, and we will discuss the same preliminary consideration next week with the board. And as I said before, we will use your feedback on that to provide an oral update to the board during that discussion. So as a very first step when dealing with methods, what we did is we tried to identify what are the potential alternatives of accounting for a transaction in the scope of the project. And in doing so, we primarily refer to the guidance in the conceptual framework, but we also consider the hierarchy in ISA, and we consider the feedback received from our outreach. And in particular, we consider IFRS standard dealing with similar and related issues, other standard setters, guidance and accounting literature, and accepted industry practice. And the alternative we initially identify are on slide 7. So we have the acquisition methods, which is described in IFRS, and is the method prescribed for normal business combination, not under common control. And, well, as you all know, in that case, the net assets of the acquired entity need to be measured at fair value. And regarding comparative information, that information is provided for the acquirer. Then we have the predecessor method, the so-called predecessor method, which is not described in IFRS standard, but is commonly applied in practice and also described in some national standard setters' guidance. And of course, we are aware that there are differences in how this method is applied, but in practice, but the common denominator is that the net asset of all the combining entity are a carrying amount. And regarding comparative information, there is, again, a diversity of difference. In some jurisdiction, comparative information is provided to all the combining entity. In some jurisdiction, comparative information is provided only for the acquirer. So there is no a clear decision on that. As a third alternative, we look at the fresh start methods. Again, this is not described in IFRS standard, but it was mentioned during our outreach, the outreach performed by the staff. And in that case, the net asset of all the combining entity need to be measured at fair value. And there is normally no comparative information provided. And as a fourth method, we have what we called allocation of costs methods, which is basically the method applied to an acquisition of a group of assets. So the consideration transfer is allocated to the net assets acquired normally without recognizing any goodwill. And comparative information in here is not provided for all combining entity, but just for the acquirer. So for today's discussion around the method, we will use the acquisition method and the predecessor method as our starting point, our primary alternative. But we will consider all the possible methods and also any possible other variation of this method as the project progresses. So we will use today the acquisition and the predecessor for this discussion of preliminary consideration. Now, the decision process that the board will need to go through is the one illustrated in slide 10. So the key question remains which methods or methods should be applied to transaction in the scope of the project, and the board might decide to that a single method of accounting should be applied to all the transaction in the scope, or that different methods of accounting should be applied to different transactions in the scope. And of course, if we, in the latter case, the board, we also have to decide how to choose between which method to apply to which transaction. Now, we initially identified two different approaches to the choices of the accounting method. So approach one, which is in slide 11, is uses the acquisition method as a starting point. And the key question here is, the key question that drives this approach is, are the transactions in the scope of the project substantially different from business combination not under common control? And of course, if the answer to this question is no, then we just need one method of accounting, and this method should be the acquisition method. But if the answer is yes, all transactions in the scope of this project are different from business combination not under common control, then we might decide whether we need one or more methods, but definitely none of this method can be the acquisition method. And then we will still need to decide how to choose which method to apply to which transaction if we go for more than one method. And finally, and this is our staff preliminary view, the answer to this question might be yes, but just some. So some transactions under common control are similar similar to business combination not under common control, and some are not. And in this case, definitely more than one method will be required to account for transaction in the scope of the project, but one of these methods should be the acquisition method. And then again, once again, we will need to decide how to draw the line between different transaction and different methods. So this is like approach one, start with the acquisition method, because this is the method we have for transaction for business combination not under common control, and some transactions in our scope are similar to a business combination not under common control. A completely different approach is approach two, so in slide 12. And the logic here is that business combination under common control are different from business combination not under common control, in that there is no change in the ultimate control over the transfer business or businesses. So given this continuity of control, some argue that it would normally be appropriate to retain carrying amounts, so to apply the predecessor method. However, they also recognize that using fair value for the transfer business can provide more useful information in some specific particular circumstances. For example, when the change in ownership interest in the transfer business is significant. Now, I'll pause in a minute and ask you what are your view on these two approaches, but I'd like to emphasize that, as we illustrated in slide 13, according to both approaches, more than one method of accounting is applied to transaction in the scope of the project. And in both cases, the board will ultimately need to define when each method is appropriate. So define some factors that entity will need to take into consideration in order to decide which method should be applied. And I'll now pose and ask you, what are your views on these two approaches?
for myself.
First of all, I agree with the preliminary view. I don't really think that there will be a dramatic difference in the outcome of the two approaches. At the end of the day, I think that if you account for a transaction, take into account the user needs, so the amount, the timing, and the significance of the impact on the future cash flows, at the end of the day, one approach or the other, the outcome should be the same. But I agree with the sub-preliminary view. I have a comment on the methods. On slide 7, when you identify the alternatives for measuring, for recognizing, the business commission and common control, I agree with starting with acquisition methods. That's some that are the most used in this case. Also in the comments that you make at the next slide about the predecessor method approaches, that I think that would be continuity from consolidated of the parent, continuity from the acquired entity. Financial statements, about the fresh start method, you just consider here that the net asset of all combining entities may be revalued at fair value, but maybe some cases in which because of the merger of equals between two subsidiaries, because I cannot identify an acquirer, I could conclude that the fresh start method is not at fair value, but rather at the accounting value, which asset and business are recognizing the consolidated financial statement on the ultimate parent. So, because there's no really, it will depend on whether you will consider more close to a business combination or not. But if you consider that it's not close to a business combination, then you could also recognize that there is no acquirer. And because there's no acquirer, you probably could consider to use a fresh start method, but not to fair values, whether to the predecessor accounting.
So in here, your concern about like a symmetry in treating, I mean, because when we apply the acquisition method, of course, we fair value the net asset of the acquired entity, but the net assets of the acquirer are at carrying amount.
Yeah, but if you do not have an acquirer,
exactly,
that's the issue, no?
Yeah, you create a symmetry, and you have to identify an acquirer and a business that is acquired. But if you apply the predecessor methods, the identification of the acquirer is not so important. I mean,
it depends on depends on which asset you want to revalue.
If we apply the predecessor method, we keep the net asset of all the combining entity carrying amounts, so it doesn't really matter who the acquirer is.
So my and point is incorporated already in the predecessor method.
I agree that the fresh start has the same consequences.
The main issue is the recognition of acquirer to me. That's one of the main issues in the business commission from control.
Christina?
Firstly, I'll just say that we support the staff preliminary view that there may be more than one method. What we did in Hong Kong is we studied the history of predecessor method, and actually the accounting for mergers and acquisitions dating back in the early 1800s. The accounting itself has only just been documented, like maybe in the start of 1950s, in terms of requiring what methods or how you would account for mergers and acquisitions. So in short, I mean, I'm happy to, you know, give a long presentation on it, but in short, what we found is our past, you know, standard setting bodies have already considered one or two methods or more. But I think the moral of the story that we got out of the study is what is really important is that we set principles and don't lock ourselves into, you know, like rigid criterias or bright lines and that sort of thing. And that's, I think, one of the lessons we learned is a lot of the criteria that was set for which method you apply was very rule-based. So we would advise that we be open-minded about, you know, what other method could be, or if there is even a need for another method. And talking about being open-minded, we thought that are we really, we could maybe start with looking at acquisition and predecessor, but don't rule out all the other types of methods that are out there. In fact, we thought, is it necessary to actually select a starting point at this stage, or should we go straight to what the conceptual framework would, tell us to do? So basically, start clean slate. Don't worry about what the methods are. What methods are there in practice? But sort of like look at it holistically, clean, and start with the concepts.
Fresh start. Chris.
So again, we'd be supportive of having more than just the two factors and being open to the other options that are there. And a bit similar to Christina, I wouldn't want to start with a predilection for one or the other, because I think the next conversation we're going to have about reporting entity and why you're actually doing this is really the factor that should be driving what is the right option. So I think starting off with the presumption that it's one or the other is not actually a very helpful thing in determining what the right outcome is.
Lynn?
I just want to share some of our experiences and see if it's helpful. The predecessor method has been required in China for some time now for the BCUCC, not only for the consolidated financial statement of the controlling parties, but also the combining parties. And we have such kind of requirement in place mainly because most of the BCUCC in China are initiated by the controlling parties. And the major objective of such transaction is to streamline the businesses or to restructure the construction of the shares. So because the controlling parties has the power, although there are minority shareholders involved, they actually can decide the timing, the structure, and the consideration of the transactions. And these transactions do not usually or necessarily follow the rules of the fair market. Therefore, if the acquisition method is allowed, we might expect great fluctuation of the asset value and manipulation of the asset value by abusing this method. And right now, the feedback is quite positive.
Okay, Andrew?
Thank you. Similar comments, really, think it makes practical sense to, at least at this stage, focus mainly on predecessor method and acquisition method. Anecdotally, in Europe, then predecessor method is by far the most common practice, but I would emphasize that's just anecdotal. Are we getting into the factors yet, or is that the next?
Not yet, in a
okay.
minute.
Okay, right. I'll pass it back for now.
Okay. Anne-Marie?
No, okay, well, so selecting methods. So, now, if we take the view that more than one method should be applied to the transaction in the scope of this project, of course, the next question we'll need to answer is how we draw the line between transaction. And we thought of a three-step process, which is the one illustrated in slide 16. So as a first step, we identify potential relevant factors. So potential relevant characteristic of the transaction that need to be considered in selecting the method. As a second step, we agree on a process to assess the impact of each of this factor on the selection of an accounting method. And finally, we bring it all together, so we consider each factor identified in step one, applying the assessment process we agreed in step two. And I mean, in slide 70, we list the preliminary factor we consider with preliminary factor we identified. And we, in order to identify this factor, we look at others under SATA guidance dealing with the requirement for the accounting of versus domination under common control. We look at published guidance on accounting for business combination under common control in an IFRS framework, for instance, a Big Four manual, and also, of course, feedback from outreach and discussions. And then when we add to agree on a process to assess the impact of each of these factors, we decided to refer to the guidance in the conceptual framework. And assessing, I won't go into detail on each single element we consider in step two, but at the end, assessing these factors will require us to answer the following question. So on each specific circumstance identified by a factor, which method would provide the most useful information for who? For the primary user of what? Of the reporting entity financial statement, but at a cost that can be justified by the benefit of the information. So really the driver are useful information, primary user, reporting entity, and do not forget the cost, the trade-off cost-benefit of the information. And I just add something regarding the primary user. The primary user we're focusing on in this project are really the external parties, so those primary users that do not have access to information without relying on the reporting entity financial statement. So of course, the controlling party is a primary user of the entity because it's the primary investor of the entity, but the controlling party has access to the information without relying on the reporting entity financial statement. Now, in step three, as we said before, step three is really combining step one and step two together, and this is where we would like your input. So for each factor we preliminary identify, we would like to discuss with you whether and how, in your view, the factor influences the decision about which method should be applied to a particular transaction, and of course, why. And from slides 25 on, we provided a brief description of what we mean by this factor, and we reminded in each circumstance the assessment process that should be applied in each scenario. So, for example, in slide 27, so the question we are asking you is, does it matter whether the transaction has been negotiated by the combining entity or directed by the controlling party? And if yes, we need to look at the assessment process. So which method would provide the most useful information for the primary user of the reporting entity financial statement, considering the cost of providing that information, when a transaction is negotiated by a combining entity and versus when a transaction is directed by the controlling party. And we will also ask you whether the answer to this question are different if there are no controlling interests in the combining entity, the transaction is affected in preparation of an IPO, or there are external lenders or other creditors, or again, the only existing investor is the controlling party. So this is how we go with the process of discussing this factor will be, but of course we're happy to listen your view and your contribution on this factor.
Andreas.
Thanks, Hans. On your list of potential factors to consider, slide 17, I suppose, I recommend probably taking out commercial substance for the reason that this has been a key factor probably in the Big Four literature that I could not describe any other as being helpless. And the reason for that is that nobody in practice seems to be so bored that they shift around boxes just for fun. So to say what is commercial substance is very, very difficult to operationalize, and probably there are other factors that you ought to be looking into. For instance, tax reasons, structures, regulation, They all come under commercial substance, but I think they are far more definitive and decisive, because commercial substance could be everything. I note especially that we note the term economic substance and commercial substance in various standards, and we don't seem to be using them the same way all the time, which creates extra confusion. And therefore, I would urge you probably to break down commercial substance and make it more definitive.
I just want you to reply on this regard, because we use the term commercial substance, but we use it with the meaning in IFRS standard. So for us, for the purpose of this list, commercial substance is really, if you go to slide at the very end, slide 33, so we define commercial substance as significant changes in the reporting entity cash flow as a result of the transaction. And these are the same concepts which is already described in IFRS standards, so in IAS 16 and 38. So in our view, commercial substance has a different compared to economic substance.
You consider also IFRS 15.
You
define a commercial substance in a different way. So,
I'm just not sure
whether it's really a good divider, really, that tells you something about where you want to go. The other comment I wanted to make, I just need to find it again. It probably has gone. Just carry on and I come back and find it.
Andrew?
Thank you. Now, I think these are all good indicators. I'm just not quite clear which way they indicate. And that's not intended to be as trivial a comment as it might sound. EFRAG, back in the day, and Francoise will be closer, know more about this than I do, apparently spent about 100 hours trying to develop, I'll call them indicators, criteria, which could give you a robust basis to say whether acquisition accounting or predecessor accounting was better. And from what I've heard, but it didn't get all that far. And so,
I'm in the dark now.
Part of the challenge is, of course, we are dealing with a very broad category of transactions or spectrum of transactions. What you're trying to do is sort of draw the line somewhere. But there are multiple perspectives, as your paper points out, in addition, sort of not really focusing on the party that controls both entities before and after, but there are parties who have an interest before the transaction in one or other entity and finish up with an interest in both. There are potential new investors who come in either as a result of the transaction or independently of the transaction who've got an interest in neither entity. I think the predecessor method gives you a sort of continuity of accounting, and if you do restate comparatives, then you get the track record. The acquisition method gives you current value information for part of the combined entity, but not for the other part, and creates a sort of discontinuity in some ways. So there are pros and cons, and I don't spoil anybody's fun, but I'd be a little bit sceptical that we're going to get too far in developing really persuasive criteria. I guess you can try and take the approach that some people in our expert group would take of saying, well, so how the more it looks like an arm's length business combination, the more we're persuaded towards acquisition accounting. But that's almost a doctrine, that's a sort of approach based on doctrine more than an objective look on what really is the most useful information. And I sort of feel maybe where we would end up in a pragmatic sense is to not leave it just a completely free choice, but to basically go down the route whereby preparers select the method that they think gives the most useful information in the circumstances, and that can be supported by more or less guidance. But I think it's too prescriptive. It's going to be very difficult to develop.
Chris?
So first up, congratulate the staff on going back to the conceptual framework. That's always a good outcome. So we're particularly pleased to see that the focus was going to be on what the reporting entity's perspective actually was, because I think that does help guide the conversation, because at least you're looking at the right entity. Having said that, I think once you've done that, there's still some other things that you need to think about from a conceptual perspective. So once you've decided that you're looking at that entity, and this is something we haven't done well in the conceptual framework, is, well, what does that entity actually represent? Is it an extract of the consolidated financial statements, or is it a separate standalone set of financial statements? And you might come up that there's actually different scenarios. So you might say in the case of a 100% wholly owned subsidiary, it's actually an extract. But you might say in a case where you've got NCI that there's actually, it's a separate standalone set of financial statements, because those NCI actually have a need to understand the financial information as if it is a separate entity. And I think that will help guide some of the consideration as to which method you actually think is the right outcome. So if I look at your specific factors, the two that stand out for me that have some value is purpose. So even if in an 100% owned scenario, if the purpose of bringing some of those entities together is to do an IPO, I think what you're actually saying in that scenario is that the new entity or the new arrangement has got value from the perspective of who's going to acquire it. And therefore, if you're looking at that, you might come up with a very different outcome than if you're staying within the wholly owned group scenario. So I think what you're actually intending to do with that entity does have an impact, and of course that leads back to all your issues with transitory control, etc. And I think I heard that Canada had a nice rule, which was that if you did a IPO within 2 years of doing a transaction, then you would actually go back and restate. So
it's in securities law.
In securities law, yeah. But that sort of seems to have some, at least worth having a look at, I would have thought. I'm not in the same camp as Andreas this time in terms of commercial substance. So both Australia and New Zealand do think commercial substance is something that you do have to look at. And so those would be the two factors we would say had some merit. I think consideration, if you start saying consideration is going to be the driver of your different accounting, you may as well throw up everything that we've ever done in accounting. So, you know, substance over form has to be your key driver as well. So consideration, I just can't see any merit for having that as a factor. And also, if you come back to the focus being on the reporting entity, I don't think that the way you make the decision matters. So if I'm an investor in that reporting entity, I'm not sure I care who made the decision. What I'm interested in is what's the impact for me. So what's the outcome of the decision, not who made the decision. So again, I wouldn't see that decision-making process is really, unless you're going to wrap it into purpose, in which case it might have some relevance, but as a standalone thing, no. So I guess upshot of all of that is we think you're heading in the right direction and keep going.
Linda?
So pretty consistent with some of the things that Chris said. I think if you look at your factors on slide 17, you're going to have to test those. Because the way I see it, rightly or wrongly, is you've got the situation you were talking about where you're going to do something in anticipation of the IPO. So that's kind of at one bookend. But in Canada, the vast majority of these transactions are for internal tax planning. And that means at the end of the day, to me, you don't want anything to flow up to change the consolidated entity. And in fact, when you look at the users, the primary user may in fact be the taxation authority. And I don't think the conceptual framework takes that into consideration. But in my experience, you know, you could have chosen to do these reorgs and you wouldn't have been doing separate financial statements for those entities, but now you're going to do them because the taxation authority is going to feel more comfortable once you've shown them this is how the whole thing lays out, and they take some comfort from the fact that you've got a set of separate financial statements that have been audited. So you need to think about and continually test those, because even in your discussion of commercial substance and how you just described it, your cash flows could actually change dramatically.
Yeah.
But I would argue that there's really no commercial substance there. Okay. Yes, at the end of the day, when you've done this and if you've done it effectively, your consolidated entity is going to get the benefit of probably a lower effective tax rate that will play out because you're now utilizing the lost positions that were in this entity, but you're producing the profit over here, and now you've smushed them together, which is a highly technical term, by the way. You've smushed them together. That's how I stayed out of any terminology there. But anyway, but the point is if you say that that's your definition of commercial substance, you have to figure out how that impacts those situations. So I think you've got a lot of great material here, but I think you're going to have to continually test it by looking at the range of transactions.
Cédric?
Thank you, Hans. Well, a lot of things have already been said. I think on what we have discussed until now, I have three comments. The first one is that it's important to know whether it's merely a reorganization within a group or whether it has a commercial substance in the case. So, and if it's a merely reorganization, we would emphasize a predecessor method, since we don't see why a new value would be created except to. Unless there is a tax issue, as mentioned in the second point is, and maybe I missed something, but an important criteria to consider is whether there exists some NCI or not. Mm-hmm. Is it because you just deal with the transaction without considering the receiving entities that you did not put that criteria in your?
We did not treat this criteria as a factor because, factor in our view is like a characteristic of this transaction. Whereas like, if who are your primary users? So if you have NCI, if you have any potential investor because you're preparing for an IPO, it's part of the assessment process. So it's really coming back to the conceptual framework guidance and reasoning on the primary user or your financial statement.
So it's still in the decision making, yeah. Just a different place in the decision making.
It's not treated as a factor because it's not a characteristic of the transaction.
Didn't you mention in slide 12 that the change in the ownership interest would play a role? To me, it was something in that direction, very similar, but maybe I'm.
Yes. This might be this was a suggestion, and I think this is actually what we have in the Canadian standard setting guidance.
So you're looking at our paper, yeah.
So it was just an example of circumstances where some stakeholder argued that.
That's our point. Yeah. I mean, yeah, okay. And finally, we just started to compare that situation with our own regulations on mergers, for example, from in French standard, and I'm not sure that I got all the concept beyond the reasoning in French GAAP, but on mergers. But for example, there is still a criteria on the compensation which is paid if it's less than 10% in cash. So you may not use the predecessor method, for example. It's something that we would like
a
to investigate.
Form results. Of the consideration.
Exactly,
method.
It's a form of the consideration, yes. And the amount of the consideration, that's a criteria that you put on your list. I'm not sure that it's very realistic. It seems to be a very hypothetical situation that you wouldn't pay the fair value from a simple regulation point of view. At least in our jurisdiction, it's difficult to figure out.
Tommaso?
Anna, again, thank you. And also, I didn't comment on the slides, but I think are well structured and well very communicative. So, thanks. I have some comments. First is about the reporting entity. When you say that you see in slide in slide 19 that you focus on the perspective of the combining entities. What do you say that you focus on the perspective of the acquiring company, so entity A?
Yes, we use a slightly different wording in here because of we wanted to capture a situation where a reverse acquisition is a reverse acquisition.
Yeah, reverse acquisition. The point is that, again, one of the central points would be if the acquirer exists or not. But once you have, I think the perspective should be the acquirer, because you should take into account the information needs of the users of the acquirer, not of the combining entity. One other comment is about factors. I struggle a little bit to have factors that are about decision making and about the purpose, because you go into the way the decision has been taken, you derive the accounting arise from how I decided to, why I decided to enter into this transaction, and why, even in a common control that could be very different and very different, take very different options, and therefore I would not really, I would more much more interested into understanding whether the transaction itself has an impact on an information impact for users, and what is it, what the users want to know about the impacts of this transaction in this particular circumstances. So again, the focus is on the user needs of the acquiring company. So I would really stay more on this point. Last comment about commercial substance, much has been said. My point was, please, you should consider also what is an IFRS 15. And another question is, in IS 16, I think commercial substance is considered only when the transaction is not acquired, paid by cash. So we are with
something. It's an exchange of assets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an exchange. So you're considering here commercial substance when you're exchange businesses? So you're paying with your, transferring your business. I'm provocative, but you know. Thank you.
Christina. The AOSSG's pretty happy to see the elements of conceptual framework being incorporated in the thinking process. I kind of looked at the steps a little bit differently. So if I look at the conceptual framework, it would first talk about, well, identify the reporting entity, then the primary users, and then provide the primary users with useful information, and it also describes information is useful if it faithfully reflects the economics of the transaction, and that to me is where substance comes in, commercial substance, what is the substance of that transaction. And then the second element of useful information is what is relevant to the users. So, which is why I think how you would go about doing it is probably all there, step 1, 2, and 3, but I would kind of look at the order a little bit differently, which is why I think commercial substance has its place, but not as, and I don't know whether you would say that it's a factor to consider in selecting the method. The other factors though, so consideration and the purpose of the transaction to the group is the most relevant to describe whether something has commercial substance. So we kind of see those two factors supporting what is commercial substance. The decision-making process is a nice to know, but we don't feel that it's too relevant. But it, like I think maybe Chris said earlier, it may be able to give you an indication on the purpose. We also thought that actually in terms of who makes the decision, it's very easy to fabricate. And I think even if it's a transaction that's directed by the controlling party, you can still arrive at a transaction that has substance in some cases.
Because, like, you know, I mean, for all of us, when we're growing up, we, you know, as a kid, you know, our parents would guide us because they know best. So, you know, it's kind of like using that analogy as well. So the parent entity may actually know what is best in terms of the operations of the group. So they may be the ones who initiate the move, but it could actually benefit the, yeah, you may get something good out of it. In terms of other factors, when we speak to investors, they would look at, they would say, well, would the transaction result in cash flows, the future cash flows that would be positive or negative? And they would look at that to determine where, or justify whether that transaction has value or has substance. So that could be something that we might want to explore. We also spoke to some, well, AUSSG, we've got very different membership in terms of the development. Some members are particularly concerned about, after we've, you know, thought about, you know, what's the right method, and let's say we arrive at acquisition method, is that really the right answer for a jurisdiction where you may not have the right governance? So I don't know whether that's something that we need to consider when we're talking about factors, but it's definitely something we might need to revisit. And I think it's quite important that the accounting method, if a jurisdiction is unable to, you know, kind of governance level-wise, yeah, you can't really provide maybe the best valuations, or you may be, it's quite easily available to get valuations, the value that you want, if you go to an expert, if you know what I mean. So then, you know, how, I mean, then what do we do? I mean, would we actually give our users, the primary users, the right answer? So that's why I don't know how to categorize this, but maybe we need to think about it.
So your concern is the availability of the fair value measure.
Yeah.
Isn't that an anti-abuse issue though, Christine?
Yeah. Sorry?
It's an anti-abuse issue.
Yeah. It's which more is, of the misuse abuse.
Which is something that issue. We always need to think about.
Hmm.
Yeah. In our standard setting. Andreas. You figured out what you wanted to ask.
Well, that's one thing. But I also want to clarify, because I think probably my words have been mistaken. I'm not saying that forget about commercial substance, it doesn't play a role. What I'm saying is it's too broad a concept to be a decisive factor, which is something totally different. Of course, you ought to consider economic practice in mind. That is what we are going to portray. Just want to make that abundantly clear. My other comment was on slide 23, where you highlight on the primary user. And I was thinking particularly of one user group being investors, being existing and potential investors, because that ties into what Andrew said. So if I look into existing investors, my answer could be drastically different from if I look into potential investors.
No.
And then the question is, do I have to present two versions potentially serving the needs of these two groups? So I just caution you that there may be a judgment call to make. And that's especially for the fact patterns that you alluded to before, where there is a prospective IPO, I think, given that you have to make your choice once at the time that the acquisition takes place, and you cannot reverse it later on when probably your user base changes, then the question is, okay, do you peek ahead or do you rely on other factors like likelihood or something like that?
Can I ask another question about the primary user group? Because I think everybody so far has assumed that the question is entirely really about whether there's NCI presence or not. But the other user group we might want to think about is lenders and other creditors. But I don't think I've ever heard anybody come up with anything in the discussion that suggests that somehow that does influence the decision about which method to pick. And I'd be interested to know whether you think there are, whether we should focus mainly on the equity investors.
Well, I could think that creditors could also play a role, I think, because if you, again, assume that an IPO is going to take place, then potentially the rights or the quality of the rights that the creditors have might change, because the potential of generating cash flow in order to repay the debt might have changed to the better or to the worse, and therefore I think they are a relevant user group.
So that would suggest that it's not just as simple as is there NCI present or not. There might be some other factors.
Because you do borrowings at different levels in a corporation, so they're relevant.
Yeah, when I was referring to users, I was considering users identified in the framework, so including creditors. Possibly, in this situation, creditors are probably more impacted than.
But then the implication of that is that probably most entities do have some creditors.
Yeah, but you have to consider all the. I think you have to consider all the. Elements of the framework, including reliability, relevance, everything, but in the perspective of the users.
I think if you go back to that conversation yesterday, though, if you've got NCI in the transaction, it's much harder to move things around that are not at fair value. And so I think if you're a creditor in an entity that's already got NCI, you're more protected than what you're going to be if you're a creditor in a wholly owned subsidiary thing. But at that point, you're probably actually more interested in the group's results than just your own financial piece of the entity that you've got your loan with.
Christina?
So about primary users, so one of our members actually suggested that maybe we need to articulate what we really mean by primary users, and they recommended that maybe we need to think about calling it external primary users of a general purpose financial report, and that would mean creditors, even if it's in a privately held group, your primary users would be, in following that definition, your creditors. So it's not just your controlling party. That was it. We did find that within AOSSG, this is an area where it really needs a lot of explanation when we're talking to people in terms of who your primary users and at which reporting entity level. Because some other questions that arise from this discussion is, if we're talking about NCI, would we need to think about the NCI of, say, the acquired entity? How far do we need to go when we're looking at primary users? And we don't really know how that is relevant yet, but that kind of came up as a question.
Okay. We're not going to make a standard-specific definition of primary users.
No.
Kim?
Thanks, Hans. Yeah, just a comment I want to make, though, is that I think that we must just be careful of necessarily focusing on the users in situations where perhaps it's going to be inappropriate to have almost fresh start accounting where companies would otherwise not be able to have a once-off revaluation. Now, this brings to mind a transaction that I was aware of a number of years ago. We had, so it was part of a global group, and this was now at the South African holding company level, and they wanted to raise financing. But again, because of historical cost accounting, their balance sheet obviously wasn't showing the real value of the business. So they now wanted to go and borrow money, but if they did, well, their financial statements would actually make them look like they were technically insolvent. Whereas, from a value perspective, the value of the assets was there, but they're not showing the assets at fair value. So what they did was they then created a new entity. They went and borrowed money, and they went and bought out the entire business, moved it all across, deregistered that other company, changed the name of the new entity to the old company, and they managed to apply acquisition accounting, which effectively resulted in a once-off revaluation. Now, the thing there is it would be, but we've got different users now. Now we've got lenders that are, you know, and it's important for them to see the real value of the business, and these were all the rationales, you know, they were given. But at the end of the day, to me, that's the wrong answer, because, I mean, that is tantamount just to a once-off revaluation. So I do think, you know, in terms of anti-abuse, we need to just be careful that we don't fall into those types of traps where you end up by saying, oh, no, well, we must show this as an acquisition, because that's tantamount to a once-off revaluation.
Chris, did you want to?
Yeah, just one last thing I forgot to mention. Just not quite exactly on point with Kim, but I think we have to think about consistency as well, and it comes back to that purpose thing. So you often see a restructure before an IPO, and you can be bringing together four or five entities to then hive off. What I think we want to try and avoid is the situation that can occur now, where you've got one at book value and the rest at fair value. So I just think from a user perspective, the end outcome of that, if it is going to be IPO'd, is rubbish, and it needs to be either all book value or all fair value.
Okay.
Just one more. so on slide 22, when you're talking, sorry, this is not no longer the question that you're asking, but I just wanted to share our experience in terms of cost constraint. So I think you're right in identifying that, well, in saying that I think most people would say acquisition method is expensive because you would need to go out and get fair values. But the benefit of acquisition method is that you'd apply it prospectively. Whereas that means for the predecessor method, cost, the highest cost is actually in having to apply things retrospectively, particularly for transactions that are not simple. And it involves more than one entity and coming from across, you know, across the group. So, and we have found that companies have often, in Hong Kong, companies have often looked at, you know, both the acquisition and predecessor method from that perspective as well. It can get quite costly if you were to use predecessor method.
I think we've
done.
Yeah, from our perspective, and thank you so much for your feedback. And as I said, we will kind of provide an oral update on that feedback during the board discussion next month. Well, to be honest, next week, not next month.
Okay, thank you very much, Anna Maria.